Hello to all my friends and all of my issues. It's a me, Mario. Woohoo! Mamma mia. You guys, you're number one. Woohoo! Are you number one? Ho ho! Wait a second, bro. Here we go. Woohoo!
Hello, Internet, and welcome to another episode of All of My Issues. In this episode, episode 16, we talk to comic book artist Ron Frenz. But this is actually part two of episode 16. So if you didn't listen to part one, stop right now and go back and listen to part one. But before we get into part two of episode 16, let's talk about Geek Fuel. If you're anything like us, and let's face it, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are. You enjoy geeky things. And one of the best ways to get your monthly geek on is to subscribe to
Geek Fuel. It's the best.
Yeah, Geek Fuel will send you a box monthly filled with comic book, gaming, sci-fi, and pop culture related material. Right now, if you go to our website, allofmyissues.com, and click the Geek Fuel link, you can save $3 off of your Geek Fuel subscription. You can use those $3 to buy Ron Frenz's new project that he's working on with Darren Henry called The Blue Baron. So enjoy.
Next question.
All right. Yeah, we were talking a little bit about Thor. Do you want to talk a little bit about New Warriors? It kind of spawned off of Thor, right?
Yeah, it did. It was something DeFalco wanted to do. We played with a couple of different ideas and a couple of different characters over a period of time before he settled on Night Thrasher. But yeah, because Night Thrasher was the only original character, right? Yeah, because it was Speedball and Namorita and
Firestar
and Van Zastra.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Where the original what was he calling it? The Marvel Boy.
Marvel Boy. That's it. Yeah, yeah.
So it was fun. I mean, I designed Night Thrasher, and that was during that period in the 90s. It was just so crazy because at one point I was actually getting, because the sales were so solid, I was actually getting creator incentive checks for New Warriors, Silver Sable, a Night Thrasher solo miniseries, and
which I have.
There might have been even something else in there too. It was a crazy time, it really was. But it was a lot of fun. Namorita, I had a crush on Namorita since Bill Everett created her back in Submariner number 50 or 51 or something like that. So it was fun doing that. And Firestar, coming from the cartoon, Tom was kind of the guy that was responsible for bringing her into the Marvel Universe. And, even at that point, that was Tom trying to create some titles that would appeal to the teenagers. And to this day, he's trying to create things that, would hopefully appeal to that kind of missing demographic. When we did that Thunderstrike mini, we decided to make Kevin more of a rebellious kid who didn't embrace his dad's superhero past and try to create a character arc that would resonate with younger people, hopefully, and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, New Warriors was very much an attempt to do that. And the hints he threw out for Night Thrasher and the supporting characters he set up and all that. He wrote a Bible for that character that became the Bible for the New Warriors that Fabian Nicieza started with when he wrote the solo book. And not that I'm trying to suggest in any way that Mark Bagley owes me his career, because he's a very he's a really talented guy and a terrific guy. But I love his stuff, I really do. But he was just starting out. He had just done a couple of annuals. In fact, I think he worked on one of the annuals I did a cover for where that introduced Speedball. And at the time, I'm trying to remember who the editor was, because it was somebody I had worked with before. It might have been Danny Fingeroth, but I'm not positive. Don't quote me on that. But it was an editor that I was very familiar with, and I'm pretty sure it was Danny. And I was really pushing for him to hire Mark Bagley on New Warriors, because he was... Dan is famously uncertain until he makes a decision. Ask everybody for an opinion before he finally makes his final decision, which in a lot of ways makes him a very good editor, although sometimes it gets a little... You get a little impatient waiting for the decision. But once the decision comes down, it's always a solid one. I remember having a conversation with him about New Warriors just because we had introduced him in Thor and everything. And I said, you can't go wrong with this Bagley kid. and boy, he did some nice work on that. It was a lot of fun. Tom wanted to use the skateboard a lot, and I wasn't really sure about that, so we did use it in the couple of first issues, because his whole name is based on the whole skateboard thing.
Yeah.
But I also just, really? A skateboard? Okay. And you try to make it as cool as you can.
Yeah.
And
when they can make Rocket Raccoon like a viable character in a movie, why not Night Thrasher, right?
If you just sell it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really all it takes, because every character is somebody's favorite character. And quite frankly, that was one of those things where because one of the characters we had discussed was based on boxing at the time. It was going to be a young character that was based in boxing. But he realized, he looked around and he saw that was when Thrasher magazine first came out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Huge.
Yeah.
So that was Tom, taking some, taking paying attention to what was going on in the marketplace and deciding, maybe we can capitalize on that to some degree. That's why he decided to go with the skateboarding and stuff. So he thought we shouldn't run from the skateboarding, and he was probably right. He usually is. Irritatingly, he is usually right. But, that's kind of something they lost when they did the new Warriors. Because at one point, I think they were even pretty much dropping the Knight and just going with Thrasher. And yet he didn't really use the skateboard much at all. So, they just meant Thrasher when it came to, beating the crap out of bad guys, I guess, or something.
Well,
thrashing bad guys.
Well, for me, I was a huge New Warriors fan, and it was like refreshing to see as an African American Night Thrasher being the leader when there was like few and far between. Because you had Black Panther and Falcon and Black Lightning, but they were always like the sidekick or never really the leader of the team, even though Black Panther was the leader of a nation.
Yeah.
So I mean,
Wakanda, come on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I understand it, but
it's Wakanda.
When people look at comics, when he's on the Avengers, it's like, oh well, he's with Captain America. But it was like nice to see, Night Thrasher was like, hey, I don't really have any powers, but I'm telling you guys, go over here, Speedball, go over here.
I enjoyed the character quite a bit, and you bring up an interesting point, because the way they're retooling some of the characters to be more diversified and everything, a lot of longtime fans have a real hard time with that, and it doesn't bother me as much as it does some people. When we were working on the books, we would try to make the rest of the cast as inclusive as possible, and it was funny because I never knew for sure whether or not it mattered. It was always worth doing for our own sake to represent New York City.
Yeah,
because New York City is just, oh my God. You don't look out at lunchtime and see a street full of white guys. That's for damn sure.
Right.
So, you know, we always tried to do that with the supporting cast, with Code Blue, with all this kind of stuff. And occasionally, you know, I would find myself in a mindset where, you know, somebody would be talking about inclusiveness and somebody would be talking about, you know, that kind of, geez, the word fell out of my head. I just used it before, with diversity.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, kind of wake up in a cold sweat and go, are we being diverse enough in Thor? And then I would, you know, going, we really need to do more diverse characters. And then I realized we got Marcus Stone and we got Rigor Ruiz and we got Samantha Joyce as his lawyer. And you know, so we're doing what we can.
Right.
You still got that Lily White lead and you're kind of like, you know, that kind of thing. So it is. It's if you have a, you know, if you have an antenna up, it's certainly something that you're aware of. And for me, it was always as much realistically representing New York as it was anything else.
Right.
You know? Yeah. I mean, if you're doing a story that's set in the middle of Ohio, then maybe you can.
Yeah, it's going to be a little different.
You got Sikhs in the background with turbans on, and you know, you got the whole nine yards.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And that's something that I always tried to reflect. And I'm glad. I'm glad you had a positive response to Night Thrasher and everything, because, you know, I am nothing if not a middle-aged white guy. You know, I mean, the character I'm working on now, Blue Baron, the lead character is Ernie Rodriguez.
Okay.
You know, and I'm thrilled, you know, and his dad has brown skin and his mom doesn't, and we certainly, you know, I don't believe that you have to go apeshit with that kind of stuff.
Okay.
But I also do believe that, you know, for every longtime fan that gets pissed off about it, there are hundreds of thousands of people that might give it a shot because now they can relate to that character.
You know? Absolutely, yeah. And yeah.
The people that went apeshit about the female Thor, that didn't bother me at all. I think probably Tom and I would have created a whole new character, and you know, because Thor is kind of his name.
Thank you. So funny, because we've had that same conversation. Like,
you know, yeah. Not a female Captain America. You have a female Steve. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Kind of thing. So I'm sure that if Tom and I would have gone that direction, we would have come up with a new name,
like Thorette or something.
I don't know. But that was always Tom's thing to begin with. I mean, when we were doing MC2, and I wanted to do a female Falcon, you know, he said, I love the idea, but we're not going to call it Falcon. I said, really? And he goes, no, come up with something else. And I came up with Lady Hawk from the old medieval movie.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
And he went, that's fine. That's great. Just, you know, but we're not just going to do a bunch of characters with the same name, because those names are already spoken for, and we're trying to create something that, you know, ultimately, you're hoping to create the next big thing that could be marketed as action figures and get its own cartoon show and all this kind of stuff. So why would you want it to be so derivative that it's the same name? You know, that kind of thing. So Tom's always thinking that. Tom always approaches every project like it could potentially be the next Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle.
That's probably a good way to approach it.
Yeah.
Smart.
Yeah, yeah. Because you put you're all into it.
Yeah, you're all in, and if it takes off, you're on a rocket ride. You know how great is that?
Yeah.
Because I mean, even when he was developing Spider Girl, when he hit his head, you know, and he told me Spider Girl, and I kind of went, Spider Girl. Okay. Can we just call her Spider Woman? Because, you know, he was a kid when he became Spider Man, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And he goes, yeah, but Spider Woman has the stink of death on it. At that point, there had already been like three Spider Women.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Except none of them were currently being published. And he said, so, you know, why be another Spider Woman? And he was right. He was absolutely right about that. Of course, now she's back to being a Spider Woman because less creative people are now in charge of such things. And we'll go on record and say that. The people that made that decision are less creative than Mr. Tom DeFalco. That I will say. And I will stand by that.
So you've had like quite the career. Is there like one specific piece or one single thing that you've worked on that like you're most proud of, Or is it just like every new thing that you work on is like that's your new baby and that's the
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I would say that absolutely characterizes any kind of creative endeavor when you're lucky enough to be part of a succession of creative endeavors. You have to kind of fall in love with the next project and stuff. But there are things that stand out. I mean, the kid who collects Spider-Man is a big one.
Yeah, we were talking about that.
Yeah. That was one of those things. It was during the transition between Tom DeFalco and Danny Figueroff. And Tom was going to give me that story, but he wasn't sure that Danny was... He says, but it's up to Danny now. So, let's wait and see what Danny wants to do. And I had already been a huge fan, Roger Stern fan, and had met Roger and, you know, liked him personally and everything, and knew what a genius he was. And I kind of lucked out on it. I can look back on that job now, and it doesn't make me want to vomit or anything. And Austin did a terrific job on it. And there, everything came together on that. I can actually look back on something that from that long ago and feel like I did a pretty good job of serving his story, and that's the most important thing when you're a penciler. So the content of the story, the emotional weight of the story and everything, I just thought everything kind of came together on that one. And
yeah, definitely.
So that one I can still look back on with a lot of pride. And, A-Next, Thunderstrike, the entire run of Thunderstrike I was very proud of. I would stand by that character. He takes his share of knocks, but the one of the things that helps me with kind of choosing the things that I can be proud of is because to this day I will get people at conventions who will come up to me and talk about the fact that Thunderstrike was a favorite character.
That's awesome.
And as I pointed out before, I mean, everybody is somebody's favorite character.
Yeah.
But it's really nice when people come up and will volunteer that information to you because it really does matter. It really does feel good that you entertained that many people. But it also, to me, is another indication of, as I mentioned in passing, it was that whole Perlman thing. Perlman's people came in and they had a big meeting where his people were part of the meeting and all the Marvel people were there and DeFalco was there. And one of Perlman's people stood up and said, here's their plan for Marvel, which is we're going to cancel half the titles. We're going to cancel half the line because the half that's left will sell twice as well. That sentence and think about it for a second. Tom laughed. And he said, right then I knew I was marked for death. He said, right then I knew I had, when I laughed out loud, I knew that I wasn't going to be long for the editor-in-chief position, and he was right. But he said, this isn't cans of baked beans, guys. These are all very individual. If you cancel somebody's favorite title, they don't just turn to the left and pick the next title.
Yeah.
These are individual product. They're not all the same product.
Yeah.
So if a kid has, money in his pocket and he's got it earmarked for a comic book and a slice of pizza, his favorite comic book, a slice of pizza and a Coke, he's not going to go in and if his favorite comic book's not there, he's going to get two slices of pizza. He's not
going to
just pick another character, So that's not going to work. And he was right then branded as somebody who wasn't going to cooperate with this ridiculous idea. But Thunderstrike and War Machine and a lot of the spin-off characters were the first ones to be canceled under that ridiculous thinking. Wow. Thunderstrike was selling terrific. It was doing fine. It was in no danger of being canceled. I mean, at one point, around that time, Ralph Macchio offered me Captain America. And I've always wanted to do Captain America. Mostly I've wanted to do it with Tom DeFalco, but I've always wanted to work on Captain America. But I was happy on Thunderstrike. We were doing great on Thunderstrike. And at the time, Ralph really wasn't comfortable with me trying to do 2 books a month. And because he had had his share of issues with me on Thor, mostly during, if you remember, and a lot of people don't remember this, several years when we were on Thor, we did bi-weeklies over the summer.
I do remember that.
Yeah,
we would go to twice a month. And I see, you know, on blogs and stuff now, I'll see people, you know, talking about how there were fill-ins on Spider-Man and, you know, friends can't hit a monthly schedule. And I, you know, in, with all due respect, I can hit a monthly schedule. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I think, you know, 7 years on Thor kind of proves that. Now, Rob, we were tight a few times, and I'm not going to try to say that, especially during the bi-weeklies. But, you know, Ralph was not comfortable with me trying to do 2 books. He said, if you want to stay with Thunderstrike, I respect that. That's great. But, you know, if you're interested in doing Captain America, I'd rather just have you on Captain America. And I said, well, let me ask you this, Ralph. Between you, me, and the lamppost, is there any reason that I should go to Captain America? I mean, is Thunderstrike okay? He goes, Thunderstrike's doing great. There's no danger of Thunderstrike. And Ralph was being completely honest with me at that moment. The fact that a couple of months later, Thunderstrike got canceled was not Ralph Macchio's fault. It was Ron Perlman's people. You know, my editor had just told me, Thunderstrike is as safe as any comic book could be. The sales are terrific. But the next thing we knew, it was gone.
That is absolutely crazy.
It sucks.
It is, yeah.
I mean, a lot of people were out of work because of that. You know, a lot of books got canceled that were doing just fine. So, you know, but to the kind of the proof of that for me is the fact that all these years later, I'm still meeting people who were huge Thunderstrike fans. You know, we were reaching a lot of fans who were enjoying what we were doing, and they were all wondering, why the hell was Apple canceled? I mean, it's, what are you going to do? You know? And A-Next was another thing that, you know, it was doing okay. It was part of the whole original first plan for MC2 was this tiered thing where you would do, you know, DeFalco had this vision of doing, you know, like 12 issues of a book and then starting another title. And because originally MC2 was supposed to be marketed. You remember the old 3 packs of comics in plastic bags?
Oh, yeah.
That was the original plan. That's why originally it was A-Next, Spider-Girl, and J2. They were supposed to be packaged as part of a deal with, you know, one of those big box stores type of thing, like Walmart's and Sam's Clubs and all this kind of stuff. They were supposed to be packaged as 3 packs in books, which is why they were this whole idea of a next generation of superheroes that kids could read and kind of join in and kind of go, oh, okay, this is fun. This is me. You know, this is talking to me and blah, blah, blah. The problem was, nobody in Marvel sales ever closed the deal.
Oh, man.
These books were never supposed to be on the regular racks in comic book retail stores. They were supposed to be mass market, you know, to an entire new audience of, you know, hopefully younger readers. And, you know, so none of them were really designed to survive in that current marketplace. And yet Spider-Girl went 14 years. You know, so it was one of those unfortunate things where, you know, the whole reason for those books existing never came to pass because somebody dropped the ball in marketing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I've had my share of frustrations like that, no doubt about it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Other question?
That's what I'm trying to think of now. I'm not, during that time frame, was that when Marvel was having a lot of their bankruptcy?
Yeah. It was shortly after that that all the bankruptcy started happening and all that kind of stuff, yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And I was under contract for the end of the Thor run and for Thunderstrike. I was under contract with Marvel. And Mark Gruenwald was in hell during that period of time because with Perlman's people in charge, they had had something called, I don't know, different people have called it Black Thursday. A couple of people called it Bloody Thursday, where just a shit ton of people in the office were being canned and stuff. It was just ugly all around. And what ended up happening was Mark was dealing with this with a lot of people, but since I was under contract, he was looking for other work for me and was just unable to find anything. You know, from what I understand, after he passed, his wife was looking at his journal, and just way too many entries were starting with, I had to fire so-and-so today. You know, I was offered, Mike Carlin had gotten wind of what was going on and had offered me a gig, the Superman gig. And I talked to Mark. I said, Mark, as far as I'm concerned, I'm a Marvel guy. If anybody at Marvel wants to work with me,
you know, right? Yeah, yeah.
And Mark really, I have no doubt that Mark really tried, and it just didn't come together. So, you know, I ended up terminating my contract and taking the Superman gig for a couple of years until the MC2 stuff came up. So, you know, I was very fortunate to have a high profile port in the storm, you know, that kind of thing. Because Carlin was somebody that I had been friendly with in the past, and Brett Breeding, of course, was over there working on the Superman books, and you know, and all that kind of stuff. So I think he had been talking me up to some degree and everything. So it ended up working out, and I got to spend 2 years over on Superman, get paid really good money. It was a tough gig though, because all the books were so interlocking that you know you had no time to think.
Yeah.
Plot, and you needed to really start producing because they were sending out weekly packages to all the different freelancers so we could see what everybody else was doing, because if you designed a character, everybody had to see it so they could pick up the next story thread, on and on. And it became very crazy that way. That part of it, the pressure of it, I did not enjoy. I, quite frankly, don't think it's my best work, because you really just had to, you know, I'm used to a monthly schedule, but you had to like boom, 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 boom. It was just amazing.
Wow. Yeah.
Really tough. But they paid for the privilege, because good money. It's good money. So
that's
wild. I mean, and I wasn't even there during the really, you know, the big death of heyday. I was there for the wedding, but that was the only big event I was really there for. Mm. Oh, and the Superman Blue stuff, if you consider that an event.
Yeah.
They actually picked my design, and I got to do, you know, TV interviews, and that piece of art of Superman standing there in the electric blue thing is probably the most reprinted piece of artwork I've ever had. It was in TV Guide, it was in Time Magazine, it was in Newsweek, it was all over the place, in newspapers all over the country, because DC they went crazy alerting the media like this was a, you know, they tried to make it as big a deal as they could, and people bet, because, you know, redesigning Superman, that would be huge.
Yeah, definitely.
And we were all under, you know, threat of our jobs. Anybody asks, this is permanent. This is Superman now. Yeah. And that's what a few of us would do when asked that direct question, you know, is this permanent? We would go, this is Superman now. That's the old to say. That's crazy. But it was fun. You know, I mean, it's all been a lot of fun. I mean, when the time comes and I wrap it up, Star Trek Generations is by no means my favorite movie, but it's famous. Is it Generations that has the death of Captain Kirk in it?
Yes. Yeah.
And that was so perfect, his last line there, when he says, it's been fun. Just spoke so much to Shatner and that character, and I just thought it was beautiful. And I have been an incredibly lucky guy. When I do talks at school, you know, at schools for kids and stuff, I always tell the kids, your dad might think he's the luckiest guy in the world, but you can go home today and you can tell him, no, Dad, I met the luckiest guy in the world. I mean, how many kids get to do the thing that they dream of doing with in a field as, you know, relatively exclusive as comics. You know, I mean,
yeah,
it's a friend of mine did some math in his head at one point. And he said, you know, comics is about as exclusive as the NBA. It's like a kid growing up wanting to play in the NBA and actually accomplishing it.
I totally believe that before,
other than to know that I was very fortunate, you know, that I worked hard and I was very directed from a very young age, and that's what I wanted to do, and I was pretty single minded about it. But the fact that I accomplished it, and the fact that I've had a 30-some year career so far in this thing, is just it's an amazing gift, and I don't take that for granted. I know you're all crying and sniffling. Ask another question.
I do have a question. I'm going to take it the opposite way, but oftentimes they say that you should never, you know, meet your heroes. What opposite examples of that do you have of people that you've worked with that just exceeded your expectations and how awesome it is, other than the legendary Tom DeFalco?
Well, as I mentioned before, I had no expectations meeting Tom, because you know, when I first heard him taking over Spider-Man, who the hell is this kid? That's another thing I've been incredibly fortunate about. John Romita is one of the nicest guys you're ever going to meet. His wife, Virginia, is terrific. And I got to know them well enough around different conventions and stuff that at one point, you know, there was some comment made about, I really only going to do that with my son. I asked John about inking me. And I was fortunate enough to work with him once or twice. But he said, no, I promised my son that if I'm going to ink anybody, it wouldn't be him. And I said, but John, I could be your son. And Virginia was standing there, and she goes, Ron, we have enough assholes in the family. I'm standing there kidding around with John Romita Sr. for Christ's sake, you know. So that was terrific. I never got to shake hands and actually talk to Jack Kirby. I did see him at a convention live and all that kind of stuff. I got to meet and shake hands with Steve Ditko one time.
Oh, nice.
Everybody was like, what's he look like? You know, it was in the Marvel offices. I was working with Joe Duffy. I had worked with Joe Duffy on Star Wars, so we were friends. And I was hanging out in the Epic offices with her and Archie Goodwin, if I'm dropping names. And also an incredibly nice man. My God, did we lose? We just lost the best when we lost Archie and Mark Grunewald. But I was in the office hanging out with Joe Duffy and Archie Goodwin, and Steve Ditko was doing a backup for Coyote or something like that. Was it called the Gin or something? I forget. I don't know if any of you guys were into the Epic Comics. But he was doing a backup for them, and he walked in, and Archie said, Ron, this is Steve Ditko. And I went, oh my God. I said to Mr. Ditko, it's a pleasure to meet you. And he goes, it's the same year. And it was very innocuous and everything. And then Archie goes, he's on Spider-Man now. And Steve went, oh, good for you. And then Steve goes, they're making him do you. And went, shame on them. And I went, well, they're not making me, sir. But I remember, you know, coming home and telling people, oh, and I got to meet Steve Ditko. What's he look like? He had such an air of mystery around himself. But he was a very nice man. And who else? John Buscema, who can be, you know, at the time he was famous for sitting at conventions and kind of being a curmudgeon and being a little contrary. I got to meet him in DeFalco's office one time. I'm not sure, but I think when I shook his hand, Tom DeFalco said, this is Ron Frenz. And I shook John Buscema's hand, and I think under his breath, he went, oh, very, very good. But I'm not sure. Ditko says that's what he said. He might have said, asshole. but I had no illusions that he was familiar with my work or anything like that. But it was at the time he was doing The Punisher, because he comes into the office and he was dealing with a younger editor. And he said to Tom, he said, "Am I going to get what I need from this kid, Tom? Am I going to get my scripts on time and everything?" And he goes, "We'll take care of you, John. Don't worry about it." And it hadn't been announced yet. And I said, "Excuse me, sir, for asking, but what are you working on out of that office?" Because I knew what books that editor was doing. Don Daly, I believe, was the editor. There's no reason I'm not giving his name. I don't know why I did that. But I said, "What are you doing for Don Daly?" And he went, "Oh, God, what's his name? Falco, what's the name of the guy with the blue shirt?" And I knew what Don Daly was editing, and I went, "The Punisher?" And he went, yeah, The Punisher. So John Buscema, The Punisher, was the guy in the blue shirt. That was amazing. And he sat and chatted with DeFalco for a while, and I was welcome to sit there and partake. And of course, becoming co-workers and friends with Sal Buscema has just been an amazing, amazing thing. Sal's the nicest guy you're going to meet. So I can honestly say that of the guys that, you know, that we originally talked about who were my influences and that I've been lucky enough to meet, I have been far from disappointed. In fact, they've been more than I ever could have wished for as far as an experience meeting them, and certainly becoming friends with Sal and being accepted as an equal by some of these guys. To this day, it just blows my mind. You know, I'll pull out my old issues of the Avengers or my Avengers Essential, and I'll be flipping through, you know, Sal's run on the early run on the Avengers inked by Sam Granger, and it's so bizarre to think, oh, that's the guy. I could pick up the phone and call him right now if I feel like it. I'm still that fanboy too, you know, and it's an incredible thing to not be disappointed by your idols. You know, I've heard of other guys who have met their idols and have been a little disappointed, and I feel for them. I really do. But I've been very, very fortunate when it comes to that. So you know, I mean, even, you know, people ask me about Jim Shooter, and, you know, Shooter, you get a different opinion from everybody that interacted with him, depending on what that interaction was, you know. And that I find that happens a lot with editors in chief. Anybody that's in a position of authority is subject to those kinds of opinions and perceptions from people, you know, because you a lot of people find it very difficult to have any kind of a real reaction with somebody who is their boss, who can hire or fire them. You know that. I mean, do you ever hear the old story that, you remember when Iron Man had a nose for a while in the 70s?
Vaguely.
Yes, come on.
Vaguely, that sounds weird. Yeah.
For some stupid period of time, he had a nose. Do you know how that came about?
Uh-uh.
Stan was looking at pages at one point, looking at Iron Man pages, and he actually said, just more to himself than to anybody else, "I wonder what Iron Man would look like with a nose."
That's awesome.
And people in that room walked out and went, "Stan says Iron Man has to have a nose now." So they tell George, poor George Tosca, and they tell the editor, and Iron Man has a nose for a while, right? And Stan is looking at comics months and months later, and he goes, "When did Iron Man get a nose?"
That's awesome.
But it's that kind of a thing, you know? I mean, I can remember somebody telling me that Tom DeFalco was going around telling people that all the comic books, because of what we were doing on Thor and because it was selling, all the comic books had to revert back to what the character was in the 60s.
Huh. Really?
Never said that.
Wow.
Somebody got it in their head. You know, and I'll bet you I know where it came from. I bet you what Tom was talking about was revisiting the character, looking at the character, and looking at what makes that character unique. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you go back to the original Iron Man stories, and if it's about man's relationship with technology and the fact that he was using technology to keep him alive. And I'll bet you he was talking about those kinds of story elements.
Like going back to the roots of the characters.
Exactly.
And stuff. Yeah.
I bet you he was talking about that. And because that, on top of me doing Kirby on Thor, somebody walked out of that meeting and went, Tom is telling everybody, DeFalco's telling everybody we got to do the characters like they were in the 60s. And it's, you know, that's the kind of shit that happens when you're the boss, you know, and it sucks. It sucks. And I never felt that Tom needed to be defended. I mean, you know, Tom would be, he would laugh when he was accused of stabbing somebody in the back. He goes, one, I try not to worry about that kind of stuff. He says, for one thing, I've never stabbed anybody in the back in my life. I like to stab him in the front so I can watch the light go out of their eyes.
That's awesome.
And he always played up that Italian, you know, threatening thing, you know, which he's a big teddy bear. None of that's true. But yeah, I really did see, you know, and Shooter is one of those, he's a very polarizing figure. People, you know, I know people who would take a bullet for him and loved him. I know people that hated him. I've worked with both. You know, as in my opinion, he did a lot of good for this industry. I mean, there's no denying the good he did for this industry, for incentives and royalties, pay rates, all that kind of stuff. I was very fortunate to have worked for Marvel in the 80s when we still had newsstand sales and when we were still mass market entertainment form. And you know, I learned how to do comics in that environment. And I'm really glad I was able to be here for the last 20 years of that, you know, that kind of thing before it all went to hell. Because those are the comics I grew up on, and that's one of the things I'm very fortunate about. But I also had conversations myself. I witnessed conversations with Jim Shooter that you know I didn't really agree with. And at one point, I even like spoke up to him, and I remember hearing again later, you know, it's, people were going, "You said that to Jim Shooter?" And I'm like, I didn't realize we weren't allowed to talk. What does that mean? You know, because so many people just let these guys. I mean, you need to be called on your on things, you know. I mean, because it was. I'll give you an example. I was in a meeting. It was one of the handful of times that I would go into New York. Back when Marvel had an expense account and stuff, I could go into New York either for Spider-Man Summit meetings or for if I was in town for a convention or if I was, you know, if there was a reason for me, whether it's a Christmas party or something like that. But I would go in for an entire day. I would sometimes sit and help proofread comics. You'd sit there with all 22 boards on your lap and help proofread. And all this kind of stuff is. I've drawn covers in the office before, you know. I've experienced, you know, the office when it was a bullpen, and it was fun. And I'm glad I had a chance to experience that. But I can remember sitting in some meetings. It was a Spider-Man Summit, I think, but Jim Shooter made the assertion. He made two assertions. One was that Spider-Man has never punched anybody in his life. Wow, that's kind of hard to swallow.
Yes. Yeah.
I can show you panels by Steve Ditko of a fist and a chin. You know.
Yeah.
So that was kind of silly, you know. But he was saying that Spider-Man doesn't hit because he's so fast, and with the spider sense, he doesn't have to punch people. And it's like, well, that's kind of, you know, retconning a lot of visual stuff,
right?
But okay, if that's how you feel about it, sir, we can kind of keep an eye on that moving forward, you know. But he also he made the assertion that the only reason I had been witness to him having trouble with a Daredevil script. And I don't remember if I was still on Spider-Man at the time or not, so it would have been sometime in the early to mid-80s, or mid-80s, that he had trouble with the Daredevil script because he said to the editor, there was no reason for Matt Murdock to put on the Daredevil costume. Now, at that point, Daredevil has been published for 20-some years.
Right.
Yeah.
His costume are his work clothes.
Yeah.
He put on his costume because he's going to swing around the city or because he doesn't want to, you know, mess up his suit. You know? I mean, so, of course, we've already established his identity as Daredevil. So, of course, there's a reason for him to put on the damn suit. But he was, it was during the period of time where he was working on his concept for the new universe, and he wanted things to be more realistic. And he's like, in this particular story, he didn't feel there was a reason for Matt Murdock to, you know, throw off his outer garment and stand revealed in his Daredevil costume. But then in this meeting, he says about Spider-Man, the only reason Peter Parker puts on a Spider-Man costume and goes out at night is to take pictures of himself for the Daily Bugle.
Oh, man.
In fairness,
that minimizes that quite a bit.
In fairness to Jim Shooter, that might not be an exact quote. I don't know that for a fact. But, you know, because my memory of it is that he made that statement, because I kind of raised my hand and I said, no. There's that whole Uncle Ben thing. And his point was, he was trying to relate it to regular people and our readership. And what he said was that, you know, if you're married to a supermodel, you're going to stay home at night. Dating a supermodel and all this kind of stuff, you know, he says, but if I'm dating Mary Jane, I'm not going out at night unless I'm doing it to make money. And I'm going, but I said, no, but what about, you know, with great power must also come great responsibility. What about Uncle Ben's death and the lesson he learned from that and all this kind of stuff? And he said, Ron, he says, listen, just because I'm almost 7 feet tall, or whatever the heck Jim Shooter is, I don't know how tall Jim Shooter is, but just because I'm as tall as I am, I don't altruistically walk and go into Central Park and help them change the light bulbs because I can reach them. Just because I have that ability or that talent, I don't go out and just use it altruistically. And I said, but with all due respect, sir, that's why we're not doing a comic book about you. And, you know, and he laughed, and it was fine, you know, that kind of thing. But he said, you know, it just doesn't make any sense to him that you get a superpower and you would act, you know, you would immediately go out for the betterment of man and act altruistically. And I said, but we have plenty of characters that don't, that get superpowers and don't act altruistically. They're called the bad guys. Electro, all these guys, they got superpowers, they become the villains. We need villains, you know, that kind of thing. So that's the other side of the coin. So, you know, I thought it was a terrific conversation. It was an interesting conversation. But again, you know, because he's the boss, later I got these reactions from people like, you said that to Jim Shooter? And he said, yeah, I said that to Jim Shooter. He didn't throw me out a window or anything. I didn't get the impression he was pissed off about it at all, you know, that kind of thing. And I think it was because he was, you know, because he as we pointed out earlier in passing, he was writing The Legion when he was 13, for crying out loud. And I think he was at the cutting edge, the leading edge of, you know, like Roy Thomas is one of your first, you know, fans turned pros guys, you know, in the late 60s there. He was one of the first guys who was a huge comic book fan that entered the industry as a professional and all this kind of stuff. Jim, all those years later, Mr. Shooter was one of these guys who I think he was on that leading edge of bringing his sensibility to the comics. You know, because what the new universe was supposed to be, you know, superhero stories in the absolute real world, the world outside your window, where if a character breaks through a wall, if it's a load-bearing wall, the house comes down. You know, when the wall is broken, you see piping, you see insulation, that was the indoctrination for the new universe. It was going to be as real can be, given the, you know, the shocking introduction of whatever the superpower or the conceit of the story was. And I think his brain was going that direction with the superheroes, you know, very much to what it is now. I mean, I'm sure it's probably relatively common now to have an issue of any given superhero where he doesn't suit up in the course of the issue. I have a feeling that's probably not all that unusual these days, you know. Although the one thing I have noticed about comics, Tom DeFalco and I have talked about this, is that superheroes tend to only interact with superheroes anymore.
Hmm.
You know, it's almost become more of like a separate fantasy world, you know, like Sword and Sorcery or Lord of the Rings or something, where you don't really get a lot of touching base with what the real world is like in the Marvel Universe, because everything is so affected by S.H.I.E.L.D. and the Avengers and the Inhumans and, you know, Asgard's Brockton and all this kind of stuff thing, that the regular world is completely affected by what's going on in the comic book story. So there is no regular Joe, you know, that the stories are told through his eyes or anything, because everybody is so affected by the stories over the last several years. You know, I mean, entire cities have blown up and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So it's really gotten to a point where it's hard to relate, which is another reason why I think Shooter wanted to go back to a world in the new universe where it was the world we're used to, and then we start introducing the Incredible, you know, that kind of thing. Instead of trying to say that people are still amazed when somebody flies overhead in New York of Marvel 616, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's really what he was reaching for. That was the point he was trying to make. And but you know, the simple fact is these characters are remarkable people, and they should be portrayed as remarkable people. Yes. Most of us, if we were dating Mary Jane Watson, would spend as much time at home as humanly possible. But Peter Parker is better than we are. Peter Parker learned a hard lesson from the death of Uncle Ben.
Exactly,
so Pete
is
going out. You know, Pete's doing his job. And Mary Jane's remarkable because she understands that. That's one of the things she loves about him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, there really are people like that in the real world. They're called firemen and policemen and paramedics. And, you know, I mean, never lose sight of the fact that a professional fireman runs into a burning building while other people are running out.
Yeah.
True.
I mean, well put, these people exist and should be celebrated. I mean, and if we can do that through the lens of a superhero, then let's do it. You know, I mean, I always loved when I was a kid reading the Marvel comics, where Stan would always take the time to tell you that the real heroes were soldiers and policemen and doctors and firemen. You know, I mean, I always loved that he would take the time to point that out. And you know, so that's where I kind of, you know, that kind of includes everything we were talking about the current state of comics and how these characters are handled, and I don't see a point in telling stories about these kinds of larger than life figures and giving them all feet of clay and making decisions that you kind of hate them for, you know, and
things like that. Yeah.
Especially when it's not something that can be rectified or, you know, that they can, you know, it's one thing for Spider-Man to make a mistake and to feel guilty about it and to try to redeem himself and everything. But come on, give him a path to redemption. I mean, the kind of stories that they were doing with the Illuminati and everything, it's like, come on, guys. This is on the character forever.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's the kind of thing that I, you know. Of course, I also recognize that, you know, we could do a reboot and start all over again. So, you know, there's that.
Yeah.
There is no such thing as forever in comic.
Very true. I think we have just one last question, I think, and then I guess we'll, because we've kept you on here for about 2 hours now.
No, it's my pleasure. Don't worry about it. I always expected to. I'm not somebody that needs you to get off after an hour because I've got 27 other things to do at 9 o'clock at night. Like I said, I'm a middle aged white guy. I'm happy to talk comics if you want.
Awesome. No, we appreciate it. We love it. I guess the question that I had too is like you mentioned you always wanted to do Captain America and stuff like that. And
sure.
Is there any other characters that you just would really like to be able to work on that you haven't had a chance to work on yet?
Sure. Sure. I mean, Cap's a big one. Fantastic Four. I've always loved the Fantastic Four characters. The idea that Marvel now exists without an issue, without a monthly copy of Fantastic Four coming out,
that is
absolutely no sense.
That is absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At some point before we're done here, you're going to have to say for me, whoa, hey, everything's fine. But anyway, there's that. I used to say,
I'll do that for sure.
Any character created before 1972, I would probably like to work on. I personally don't like the redesigns on the Vision. But the original Vision design I thought was so cool, and I would have loved to. I've never got to do the Vision looking like the Vision. Mm. I mean, he came back into the Avengers for a while there, but he had a different look, and I drew the different look dutifully, and all that kind of jazz. But I loved the Vision. I would have loved to have done a run on the Avengers. A-Next was as close as I ever got to a run on the Avengers. Iron Man's a terrific character. But I think, I'm not into detailed tech and everything. So the way the character is handled now, I like it. I think it's terrific and it reflects the films. But I don't think I would be right for something like that. That's not something I really enjoy. You know, the classic Iron Man, we actually did a couple issues of Spider-Girl where, Tony Stark went back into action and not surprisingly, he pulled his old armor out of mothballs, just wore the 60s armor.
Oh, nice. Yeah. That's cool.
And looked suspiciously like George Tuska was drawing him. You know, it's weird how that happened. On comic books sometimes. But there's a bunch of characters I never got to, because I got to work on Spider-Man. We got to do a bunch of guest stars, certainly on Thor. Captain America guest starred quite often and would show up, and I would get to do gotten to do my share of Cap. I've done two fill-in issues of Captain America, and covers and backup stories. DeFalco and I did one. It was a lot of fun. We did. We retold the story from that issue of Sergeant Fury where he meets Captain America. We retold it from, it was like a 10-page backup in an anniversary issue of Captain America, where we told the same story from Cap and Bucky's point of view.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And it was fun because, I was channeling Kirby and Ayers and got to draw, the classic characters, got to draw Sergeant Fury and Dum Dum and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that was one of the pieces of casting. I've always just had a fondness for the character of Dum Dum. And he was so perfectly cast in Captain America, the First Avenger. I thought they did a terrific job casting him. And he got to show up on Agent Carter.
Agent Carter, yeah.
I enjoyed it. I liked that actor a lot, too.
Yeah, I did, too. I would have liked to have seen more of that, actually, on Agent Carter. I think that would have been awesome.
He was wow. I mean, that episode they did where she teamed up with the Howlers and they were even handling, they even name checked a couple other characters. Sergeant Fury book and everything was just, I was one of my favorite episodes of the series because I enjoyed those characters so much.
Yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree.
There certainly were books that I would have liked to have worked on. There were characters I would have liked to have handled, but I can't complain about the stuff I did get to do because when you get to be on a book like Thor for 7 years and he is involved in the Avengers and you can use Avengers Mansion and you have the entire Marvel Universe as a sandbox to play in. I mean, I always wanted to do Annihilus, and we weren't on Fantastic Four, but we did a story where Asgard, when it was floating without the bridge, it went into the negative zone, and that was so I could do Annihilus.
That's awesome. Wow. That's awesome. Yeah.
That kind of thing. And I pitched it to DeFalco, and he went, yeah, we can do that. That sounds fun. I on Spider-Man, I've always been a huge Spider-Man fan. from the time I was a kid. And when I got on the book, I wouldn't have minded doing all the classic villains, but Tom set policy, you know, and he said, Ron, what I'd like to do is I'd like to spend the first couple of years, which ended up being our entire run. We were only on for like 2.5 years before we got fired. He said, I'd like to spend that creating new characters. And that's what we did. You know, created the Puma and Black Fox, and Silver Sable, and on and on. And did the mysteries with the Rose and
Hobgoblin.
Hobgoblin. And everything. And it was great fun. But, you know, when we ended up doing some annuals later on, and we were looking for, because we were supposed to do like a flashback story for an annual, and we're kicking around ideas of what to do. And I said, well, here's one that's never actually been talked about, is how about if we did a story about the exact moment that Captain Stacy figured out that Pete was Spider-Man? It was back in 96. And it was the time I got inked by John Romita Sr. It was half of an annual that... The other half was, I think, Fabian Nicieza and Steve Lytle, I think, doing a black costume story. But what we did, we set ours back during the Lee Romita stuff. And, you know, that part of it, of Captain, that moment where Captain Stacy figures it out. Because somehow, it had never come out that Joe Robertson knew. Okay? Mm-hmm. Between you, me, and the lamppost, my attitude is Joe Robertson has always known. Mm-hmm. That he and Captain Stacy probably figured it out around the same time.
Exactly.
They were discussing it all the time. But since it had not been revealed in any way that Joe Robertson knew, we were just going to do a story where it was more of a personal thing that Captain Stacy figured it out. Whether or not he shared it with Joe, that's another story, you know, that kind of thing. But the period of time we were placing it, gave me the option, and Tom said, are there any characters that you've been wanting to draw that you never got a chance to draw in Spider-Man, because we were just creating new characters? And I immediately went, Kraven the Hunter.
Nice.
So we put Kraven in that story. You know, Tom was very accommodating because it worked out, because Kraven had dealings with Norman Osborn around that time, and we just had, you know, it all came together into a nice little story that what was weird about it was we had to do it with a framing sequence with Ben Reilly, because Ben Reilly was currently Spider-Man. It was in his Spider-Man costume. But fortunately, Ben Reilly has all the same memories that Peter Parker has. So yeah. We were able to do the flashback. You know, it was just we had to use Ben in the framing sequence. But and that was fun too, because I always liked that costume. That's why we ended up using it with Spider-Girl and stuff. I thought it was a really cool design. I thought it worked really well with the female figure.
Definitely.
Anyway, I forget what the question was, but yes, there are plenty of characters that I don't get to do. And when we did a Web Spinners two-parter, Tom said, any other characters you'd like to do? I said, if it's all the same to you, I'd really like to do Dr. Octopus. We never got a chance to do Dr. Octopus.
So, oh, nice.
You know, we did him along with the team we had put together at the Sinister Syndicate with the Beetle and Hydro Man and the Rhino and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, so, yeah, I mean, I've been really, really fortunate working with DeFalco and just being... You know, in the trenches with the Marvel 616, I've had a chance to do a lot of really cool stuff that I look back on fondly. No complaints.
Awesome. Well, before we stop recording here, I just wanted to give you a chance too to plug anything else. I know you were talking about the Sid Comics, and if you wanted to give out any URL or anything to where they can get that from, Comixology, you said.
Yeah, it's all, the Sid Comics titles are available on Comixology, but I'll tell you what, the best place to go is the Sid Comics Facebook page, and it's SIDCOMICS, one word, and it's on. He's on Facebook, and he posts updates on the production of the books, and there's connections there to other websites, and probably find a link to Comixology and everything. But you know, that'll give you some background on the characters and everything. And please indulge yourself and be prepared, because there is going to be a hard copy rollout coming next year. and I'm really looking forward to it. I hope we have a success on our hands. God knows it's difficult to break into the comics market. I don't know exactly what all he has planned marketing-wise, but, you know, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And the fact that, you know, the industry has managed to get some fresh eyes on some of the material lately with some of what they've been doing, hopefully we can kind of lean into that and entertain a new group of fans. So it would be very gratifying if this thing could catch on. But you guys, now you have to go to Comixology or mail order from him a hard copy or something, and you need to read the stuff, because the next time we talk,
absolutely, yeah.
You know, if we ever talk again or I see you at a show, if you haven't read Blue Baron, then well, I didn't give you a copy at the Pittsburgh show.
I don't think we did.
No. Well, I suck.
That's all right. Yeah.
Yeah, I was handing them out. If a couple of people offered to buy them, but if they showed any interest at all, if they weren't going to buy it, I was happy to give it to them, because it was a box that I just bought from him for promotional copies and stuff.
Gotcha. Yeah, I got a couple prints off you, and Chris got a drawing, an original from you.
Yeah.
Well, what?
Well, my son really wanted the Flash. I was all ready to get a Spider-Man from him.
Yeah, I remember that. Sure.
Yeah.
It was a side shot of the Flash.
Yes. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's framed and all.
I remember that interaction because you were going to get him a Spider-Man, but
my son loves Speedsters.
See, kids are honest with you. That's how that.
That's how, yeah.
Did you see it on the? I guess it was printed on. It was a little brief video. I think it might have been on Instagram or something like that. Of the new Spider-Man, Holland, going to a hospital, and he goes in full Spider-Man costume.
Get out. That's awesome.
Kid, and he pulls off his mask and, you know, he's talking to the kid, and the kid's wearing a Batman t-shirt. He said, "So you like Batman?" And he goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "Do you like Batman better than Spider-Man?" And the kid goes, "Yeah." "Why do you like Batman better than Spider-Man?" And the kid just looks at it for a second and goes, "Poop." So there you go.
That's it. That's awesome.
I'm not saying my interaction with you guys was anything like that.
good. Because we'd love to have you back on when the comic comes out in hard copy form.
Oh, that'd be terrific. Yeah. I'm looking forward to I really don't do a lot of shows these days. I don't enjoy traveling as much and everything, but when these books finally roll out, I am planning on taking every offer I can get to do a show to promote and to make sure that, you know, we get them in front of people's eyes. Darren's already been doing quite a few shows in his area. He's out in California, and he's been doing a lot of shows to you know, just burn through the shoe leather and shake some hands and let people know it's coming and all that kind of stuff, you know. But yeah, please check out the Facebook page and look back at the photos. I mean, he runs pages as they're being developed and everything, and see if there's anything in there that strikes your fancy. And if you like it, tell everybody about it. And if you don't, keep your mouth shut. anyway, it's been a pleasure, guys. Are we wrapping up then?
Yeah, let me stop recording, and if you won't mind staying on, we'll talk a little bit off the record.
Okay,
that's okay. All right. This is Rick back again. That's the end of our podcast. I hope you enjoyed our discussion with Ron Frenge as much as we did. And one of the things that we had talked about after we were done with the podcast is having him back on the podcast at a later date. So stay tuned for that as well. In the meantime, you can find us at allofmyissues.com, at allofmyissues on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram. If you want to email us for any questions or any topics for a podcast in the future, you can email us at allofmyissues@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.